Good morning, and thanks for joining. Welcome to the podcast, Something to Believe In. I'm Steve Roberts. This is the lovely Allie Bills, and we're happy to be here with you today.
Always.
We have a great, great guest for you. I think it'll be very compelling.
There is no doubt. A little bias. One of my favorite guests we've had on the show, but...
Well, it should be, Allie.
Yes.
Well, before we get started, I just kind of want to give a shout-out to the people. I don't know if you've been following the news, but that is a tragedy. Been going there since I was a little kid. A lot of memories there that are just now burned down. A lot of lives lost. I don't know that they have the final count, but it breaks my heart. I think about it every day.
We're all connected to Hawaii in some way. We feel like it's home because it's our refuge from life. But I saw Good Morning America yesterday. They had people give donations. They started at 100,000, and they're, as of this morning, they were at like 3.4 million. But the people, there's so much love there.
I know, and there's a lot of those homes have been there since. There's a lot of history there, and that banyan tree, it's 150, 160 years old, right? If you've never seen it, it's, well, I don't know what it looks like now, but it was amazing, just fascinating how big it was.
Yeah, there's going to be some beautiful stories that come out of this, but the heartache right now and
it's painful.
Is awful.
So, gotta share a story.
Of course,
before we get started. So, many of you know my son graduated from the University of Utah this past year. I can't remember. Maybe it was last year. They're all blending right now, and he applied to get a master's degree through Temple University in Japan. And he's always wanted to go to Japan because he's been fascinated by the culture in Japan. I've never been personally, but he moved home and he got accepted, which was exciting. And he moved home he kind of stayed at home during those last couple of years because of COVID and all that. But it was interesting because when he was at home and after he graduated, I don't know if he thought he was a full-fledged adult because he was 21 in February
and he's ready
and a college graduate. Yes. So, you know, he's going through that phase. And the first night he went out with some friends and we have a chime on our door. If it opens and at 1:20 in the morning, the door chimed. And the parent in me immediately wanted to jump up and have a chunk of his hiney.
Past curfew.
Yeah,
for sure.
I mean, it's like, but I didn't. I let him go to bed. I got up the next morning and I said, hey, I just need to disclose something. 1:20 doesn't work in this house. Nothing good happens past midnight. And all your brothers knew that. That was our rule of thumb. Nothing good happens past midnight. And he said, well, Dad, I can't wait. You know, I'm going to be on my own. I can do whatever I want. And I'm ready to get out of the house. And I'm like, okay, cool. You know, no problem. So we dumped him off in Japan 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. And my point is, he's called every day since. So I guess it wasn't so bad.
I guess he misses you then.
I guess so. But what was really interesting was I've never been to Japan. And in Tokyo, I guess you can fit like 13 American cities within the confines of Tokyo. And so there's, I don't know how many millions of people, and it's just packed. And what was interesting to me was I never saw a homeless person the entire trip.
Really?
Not one. I never saw any people, you know, panhandling, or I never felt unsafe. And I noticed a lot of people were riding bikes, scooters, you know, to get around because of traffic.
Yeah.
Nobody was honking their horn if somebody wasn't going. I never heard any horns in the city. But what was fascinating was people would just park their bike and get out. And go do their thing. They would leave their bike or their scooter. But what was more interesting is they weren't locking them. And I'm thinking that would be gone in like 3.2 seconds here.
They would have major culture shock coming here.
It was unbelievable.
Lack of patience.
The cleanliness. The thing I didn't understand was I couldn't find a garbage can anywhere. I didn't know that you're supposed to carry your garbage with you. Until you get to your destination, and then you can jump off your garbage, wherever that is. And it was clean, right? It was very clean. But there's no drinking on the street, no eating while you're walking. They consider that poor time management, that you need to sit down and do that on your time and carve out the time to eat and drink or to be social. But very, very nice people.
Beautiful people. And they're so cute. The sense of humor is very different.
Yeah, and the willingness to help. I mean, a stranger was, it was unbelievable.
Yeah. We could adopt a few of the things from them and bring it here. I don't know how we could ever implement them, but they have a beautiful culture.
They do. Very proud. And it was, I just kept thinking, why, what are we missing here? What? It was just a lot to learn, a lot to take in.
And you weren't expecting that.
I didn't know what to expect. I've never been to Japan. I've never been to Asia. The plane ride sucked.
It's not short.
No, it wasn't. And it was a 15-hour time difference. So it took me a week to, I felt like I was in a dream when I got back for a week.
I'm sure. Well, Japan is a place I've always wanted to go. Yeah. My dad served a mission for the church in Japan. Four of his brothers, his parents were mission presidents. He went back and did work there. And my brother was born in Japan. Oh. And it was awesome. My dad's family would always try to speak Japanese, especially my grandma, and they'd just end up laughing because it didn't work out so well.
Yeah.
And I was in love with it, and so I studied a Japanese style of martial arts and had all of this Japanese stuff in our house. So we loved the Japanese culture. We had some Japanese exchange kids that were close by and always at our house, and they just have a really childlike sense of humor. So
yeah, it was,
such good people.
It was great.
So
it was
I'm great. Jealous you got to go over there.
The one thing is we have a no-shoe rule in our house, and of course my son, all my sons, they don't partake,
yeah.
Which drives my wife crazy. But we got my son's little apartment, and we got him set up, and my wife no more stepped in, and she walked in this little closet they call apartment, and she had her shoes on, and he threw a fit. And I'm thinking, well, you didn't abide by that rule ever. But anyway, let's talk about our guest.
Yes.
I know you're very passionate about that. His story, I don't know a lot about it, but I'm dying to hear about it.
Awesome. Well, if Ryan wants to come in. So today, I'm excited to...
He's a big boy.
To share my brother with you guys. So this is my brother Ryan, and kind of the topic today is addiction to hope. And as you go through these seasons in our lives, sometimes we feel like we're in winter for a really long time. A lot of us feel that way in work, just with the industry. But I heard a quote that was really good. Good times create weak people. Weak people create bad times. Bad times create strong people. And I think we're learning that right now, that when you're in the winter, you really have to dig deep, learn a lot about yourself, and you find a way to get out of it. And Intercap's giving us tools as employees here to find ways to be better, to overcome some of the struggles we're facing that are out of our control. But a lot of us get into a season that lasts longer than we want because of addiction. And I wanted my brother to share his story with you. And so he's one of three older brothers that I have, and I have a younger sister. And Ryan probably won't share this part, but he was like all American in three sports in high school. Great student and, a favorite child to parents, and had just a huge upside. And so I'm going to have him share his story from kind of his first drink to sobriety. And in a nutshell, so just in about 4 to 5 minutes, and of kind of what happened in his life, and finally, you know, what were some of the things that helped him to finally move forward out of that after trying to quit several times. And, a lot was lost, and a lot of things you can't ever escape from, and your past does follow you, but there's always hope. There's always, the sun always comes up the next day. And so... to not to ever give up on that mindset and that idea. So Ryan, if you want to share, thank you for sort of coming.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Just maybe 4 to 5 minutes
okay.
of your history.
So I was a senior in high school. I was all state in three sports. Was getting ready to go to San Diego State on a football and baseball scholarship. Senior graduation night, my senior year, I decided to join the crowd. And I drank for the first time. It was my senior year. Well, by the time I left 3 months later to go to San Diego State, I was an alcoholic. It hit me that hard, and I got to San Diego State, which is one of the biggest party schools in the United States, and I was a raging alcoholic. I was the first freshman to start on their infield in 15 years, and because of alcohol, I lost that position. I got in trouble. I ended up getting kicked out of San Diego State at the end of the year. Came back to Utah Valley to play baseball with under Vance Law as our coach. I pitched one game. We were playing to see who went to the Junior College World Series, and I hadn't pitched in 2 years. They put me into pitch, and they clocked me at 102 miles an hour.
Oh.
So I was a preseason All-American going into the next year for that one inning. I got drafted by the White Sox at the end of that year, but I was told, and it was late rounds, but I was told with one more year, I would be go first round. So my brother and I, he had just gotten off of a mission. We were playing together. We both got full rides to BYU. I was the wild child, and he was the perfect child for them. At BYU, they decided right before the season started, they decided that they were going to redshirt me because I was a liability to the team because of my reputation. So I wasn't prepared to stay in school. I was barely making grades. I was there to play and go pro. So I ended up throwing the desk on the coach, walked out of his office, and left. I went to tried out for the Trappers. They flew me to Huntington Beach. I made their team. But I had a wife and a baby on the way, and they only paid $800 a month to play, and I couldn't live off of that. So I played fast pitch softball for Larry Miller for a year and started my life. But everything I'd worked for my whole life was all of a sudden gone. Sports, you know, I'd lost everything. So, and I was full on in my alcoholic addiction by this point. Well, at this point I decided alcohol wasn't enough. By the time I was 21, I had 3 DUIs, and I switched to meth, and I became full-on addicted to meth. In 2000, I was Utah's most wanted. They said I had pictures of me on the news morning, noon, and night. Convicted meth cook and gun dealer on the run, and I was being hunted by the police. They had a shoot on site, order out on me because they thought I was armed and dangerous. I ended up meeting with an attorney. And he told me that they had this order out on me. I was having dreams that my girlfriend at the time got shot while the police were chasing me. So I turned myself in front of Fox News just so I didn't get shot. Ended up doing 19 months in jail. I got out, went right back to the same life. And it continued about 5 years after that. I was in a car with my wife at the time and a friend. The cops pulled us over, pulled me and my wife out of the car, cuffed us, put us on the ground, and then they killed my friend in my car. They blew him away, put over 100 bullet holes in him for something he had done. My wife and I got charged for what he had done, so I was back in the court system again. My life was complete shambles. In 2019, my wife and I split. She left. I got in a serious motorcycle accident, broke my shoulder, broke my third and fourth vertebrae. They said I would never walk again. Had road rash from head to toe, broken foot. And so I couldn't work, lost my house, lost my truck, lost everything. I was moving in with my parents to try to get better because I couldn't even walk. And my dad they gave my dad 30 days to live. They said he needed a quadruple bypass. He had pulmonary fibrosis, and they said he had 30 days to live.
This was 2 years ago.
Yeah, I was dwelling in their basement, not really living, just doing drugs and just down there, just wasting away. And I realized that my dad, who was probably my very best friend in the world, was about to die, you know. So it was a real eye-opener for me. I had already lost everything else. Anyways, we made it through that 30 days, and he started to get better. And I realized that it was an opportunity for me to start. So I went and checked myself into a facility to start to get better. I wanted nothing more than to be able to spend time with my dad and to be there for him. So December 1st, 2020, I checked myself in. No, 2020, I checked myself into a program. I got out of the program, have custody of my son, who's 17, and was working, going through the program, trying to get my life together. I was living at my parents' house, taking care of them. I ended up getting a job, moved into an apartment, and then my dad took a turn for the worse. So in April, I quit my job, and I moved back in with my parents. We were finishing the basement of their house at the time, but I moved back in with my parents to take care of my mother, who was, her health was failing because she'd been taking care of my dad and not taking care of herself. And then to be there to take care of my dad, he needed help getting to the bathroom. He needed help with everything. So I started to cook all the meals, keep the house clean, and give my mom a break so she could start to live again. She started driving the car again, was able to go to the store, go to the temple, go do the things that she wanted to do because I was there with my dad. Probably the most healing thing in the world for me was spending that time with my dad, these last 3-4 months that he was alive. We had a lot of fun. He was doing great. We were sitting there watching TV on July 10th, watching a show called Suits.
Oh, yeah, that's
a big show. He started laughing, and then he just tipped to the side. I grabbed him, picked him up, saw that he was having a heart attack or something. By the time I laid him on the ground, he had passed. Gave him CPR. But I think for me, the most important conversation that I had with my dad was, he said, you know, I really feel like it's okay for me to go now because you're back and you're here to take care of your mom. And so after everything I had done, all the problems, all the headaches, all the trouble that I'd caused and the humiliation that I'd caused my family, he knew that I was going to be there.
It was okay.
For my wife, for his wife, you know, and my mom.
Wow. I'm not usually at a loss for words. That's hard. That's a tough one. I appreciate you sharing that story. I think for me, it's like lots of questions, right?
Dig deep. He's an open book.
I can see that, and I appreciate that. I know that's not an easy story to share, but I want to start with saying congratulations.
Thank you.
Congratulations for taking your life back. Congratulations for stepping up and recognizing and owning it. I think that's step one, right?
Absolutely.
It's just owning it. It is what it is. None of us are perfect. And we've all done things that we wish we could go back on. But it's really hard for people as a society to be able to say, you know what? It's on me, man. I can do better. I'm going to do better. And you're making a choice to do better. So kudos to you for that. Second thing I think of is you were a far better athlete than I was. I was an All-American. I was first team JV. No, I mean, I was something, darn it. But I understand, even when I was, you know, playing a lot of sports, it's easy to get into that. And what people don't understand, whether it's drugs, alcohol, anything, there's a lot of addictions out there, and we're faced with that all throughout our life. How are you now mentally compared to them? I mean, do you still have those thoughts? Do you still find yourself thinking, oh, God, I want to go back to that?
You know, I think the first step that comes in getting rid of the problem is understanding that you have a problem, and you've got to, you know, you turn your life over to your higher power, which sounds odd.
No,
I don't drive the bus anymore. You know, I've got a higher power that I have confidence and faith in that is going to take care of everything. All I worry about is doing the next right thing. You know, that's it. I don't have to worry about what's going to happen tomorrow. I do the next right thing, and I know that as long as I am doing that and living that practice, that things are going to work out.
So what about relationships? I'm sorry if I'm digging too deep.
No.
I mean, there's a lot of when somebody's addicted to something, and your story, I'm sure there was a lot of relationships that were hurt along the way.
How are you
repairing those? How are you repairing yourself, and how are you repairing those relationships?
So I went through 3 marriages in my divorce, in my addiction. My first wife that I have 2 children with, she's remarried and has 2 kids of her own. So her and her husband, who they're the greatest people in the world, they raised my 2 kids and their 2 kids. And those, their entire family has been a part of our family. They come to all of our family functions. I consider her husband a brother, and she's like a sister. You know, my parents always, they always taught us that you can never have enough people in your life to love you. And we wanted my kids to have all the love that they could have. So they became a part of our family. He's like a brother. I love him to death. He is a great man. And but having them as a part of our family is just, you embrace everybody, you know, and you love everybody. And everyone that's trying to take care of the kids need to be on the same page.
Right.
You know, so that was a great relationship that I have with them. You know, I've had to repair some things with my siblings. My son from my second wife, I have custody of him. He's with me, and he's turning out to be a great boy. You know, he is going to be a great kid. He's doing very well, and he's with me.
So what about, you know, it's being a sports guy, I still have dreams about sports. Like in high school, like there's times where I can't, my feet feel like they're glued to the basketball court and I can't move. And it's like, oh, I got this shot, but I can't move. do you look back and have regrets? Well, and if you do, how do you move past that?
Well, I think there's tons of things that I wish I would have done differently. But as it all's played out, I know that right now I'm right where I'm supposed to be. I love to help people. I love to work with kids in sports or in any aspect. But I think you have to be able to realize that things are different. I have new passions now. I love motorcycles, dirt bikes, and I do things that are athletic and active, but I haven't played, you know, I beat my body to death. I've died 3 times. I've 5 bullet bike accidents, 4 motorcycle accidents, been in about 25 major car accidents. So my body does not, I have 15 screws, 2 plates and a rod in my left ankle. And I have 8 screws and a plate in my right ankle. I don't run much, you know. I ride bikes and I do other things, but So I just enjoy the things that I can do. And, you know, I try not to live off of regret. I try to take the approach of gratitude, you know.
I love that.
The things that I'm grateful for and that I can do, I focus on.
You know, when he was using and would be around, one of the things I struggled with was that he had this passion for these sports growing up, and he was so good at them, but he never wanted to watch them on TV. He never wanted to follow teams. And at a certain point, you know, I thought maybe it's just, it hurts too much to watch it. And it's a part of his life that he kind of just threw away. And so he doesn't want that to be, you know, something reminding him all the time. But I think, you know, as he's gone through the recovery process, then he has been able to gain more gratitude, but also the importance of continuing to having passions. When you've been an athlete and you've been addicted to exercise and fitness, you have an addictive personality.
Yeah.
So it's not hard to transition that into a drug or something else. He's always going to be an addict. I mean, I told him already, if you want to come on the podcast, you're great. He's like, yeah, but I'm in my beefing up phase. So how about wait till we get to my cutting phase? Because he lifts every morning. But you have to replace that addiction with something else and passions.
Healthy addiction.
A healthy addiction. And they don't go away.
So what would – I mean, look, I guarantee – I don't know how many people are on this today. Hopefully a lot. But we all know somebody, right? It's like when I – was a loan officer and I'd pull somebody's credit and they thought they were perfect. If I dug deep enough, I can find a skeleton. We can all find a skeleton. We've all had family members, loved ones, whatever, that have had addictions. How would you say that we approach that? As a person that's not, right? As say you could transform into us right now and we had to deal with you. Looking back on it, what would you recommend?
Well, I think the best way to approach it for a family member is you love unconditionally. You love them, you accept them, you embrace them, you let them in, you keep them in your family, you keep them included. You know, the last thing you want for someone dealing with addiction to do is to feel isolated and to feel like they're broken. You know, they're not broken. They just are dealing with issues, and every one of us deals with issues.
Right.
You know, the more love that they have and the more welcome that they feel gives them a place where they have to go when they're ready to work through it, you know.
How important, you know, we talked a lot about, are we enabling Ryan as a family?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
We're letting him live here. He has an addiction. Are we enabling Ryan? But the alternative is abandoning him. And, you know, my parents always said, first of all, we'd rather have him here than out where he can hurt someone else because of a bad choice. Two, there was always this hope when he's like, hey, Dad, I'm clean. My dad's like, okay, Ryan's doing good. He's clean. I'm like, Dad, he's not clean. But parents want to believe that they are. And I do think that that's okay. You have to be realistic, but that's okay because you still believe in your kid. And I think, how important was it for you when you decided to change to know you had a place to come back to?
I honestly, I don't think I could have done it without having the support of my family. Knowing that they were there, knowing that I had a place to go where I was safe, where I was away from everything, where I could heal and get strong again, you know. Because if you put someone back in the same situation that they were in and they want to change, it doesn't happen. They have to have a place where they can get away from it and get strong, you know, get healthy. And I personally, I think it's dangerous for them to go, you know, it's a lifestyle that you have to change, you know. People, places, things that you do, you have to be able and willing to get rid of all of it. But if you're willing to get rid of all of it, then you need a place to go where you can be safe to get better.
You know, it's and I'm not going to lie, I'm a hypocrite here, because I've found myself, you know, you look at these people, and let's go athletes, let's go movie stars, let's go wealthy people, and then you idolize these people. Then one day you hear that, oh, they've got an addiction, or they're on drugs, or they're on alcohol, and it's like, you've got everything. What in the hell are you doing? Right? I've been guilty of that. We've all been guilty of that. And I don't think we understand your story. You know, what got you there? What made you? Was it just you start something? Was it a gateway? And what were you looking for?
Well, I think when I was in high school, I did my own thing. I had my own workout routine. I got along with my teammates. I got along with everybody, but I never joined in because I held myself to a higher standard. And for that one night, I wanted to be included, you know. Ooh. But when you have an addictive personality and you have, it's an allergy is what addiction is. It's an allergy that you have. And when you have that allergy, all it takes is tasting it, and it lights up. I had, you know, my grandfather, it was an alcoholic, so I knew that I had that potential.
Yeah, right.
You know, but I didn't I was 18 years old. I didn't understand what it meant.
An 18-year-old that thought you were invincible.
Yeah.
And nothing could.
Right. I thought that I was untouchable. You know. I'd lived my life a certain way up to that point, and I'd accomplished just about everything that I wanted to accomplish. And I didn't think one night was going to make a difference.
Right.
But that's all it took, was that one night. I mean, I was the guy at parties that would go around and drink all the beers that were left. I just couldn't get enough.
Well, but it kind of makes sense if you think about it. I mean, I know I've met you for a minute before we started this, right? Mm-hmm. I've known Allie for many years. You guys are very similar in that you don't go halfway.
No.
It's all in. So that personality would be easy to, I guess, get that way, right? I mean, it's people don't understand that personality, when you're like, I'm going all or none. Right? You don't get to be all American in three sports by being halfway.
Right.
It's all in.
Yep.
Wow. So what now? What are you doing now? What are your goals now?
Well, for me, my biggest goal is staying clean and sober is obviously first and foremost.
Yes.
But also, you know, there's a lot of people out there that, and part of the 12-step program is giving back and helping.
Paying forward. Yeah.
And there's a lot of people that are in need of help.
Oh, I agree 100%.
And so making sure that I am available to help.
Helping to help.
Yeah. And you can't just be available time-wise. You've got to be mentally prepared and physically strong and have your ducks in a row in order to help others. So I really take a lot of pride in being able to help others right now. You know, it's something that I look forward to doing. I'm still active in AA, and I always will be.
So what about, I feel like a lot of your story being athletic, I feel like a lot of kids athletically need to hear your story, man. I feel like a lot of people need to hear your story. This has been amazing for me. And I could go on for hours asking more and more questions because I see it.
We have hours of stories.
But it's around us.
Yeah.
And it's easy to look at people and think, oh, they're fine, or oh, you know, let's let them do their thing or whatever, or to judge, right? Mm-hmm. And we as a society really don't know or understand, for the most part, really what's going on up here.
Right.
Right. We just don't. We just judge. Oh, you know, it's easy to kick somebody to the curb or
sure.
to give up on them. I think a lot of people need, I think you have a lot of good in your life to give.
Yeah.
A lot.
It's so easy just to turn and walk away from somebody as opposed to going up and putting your arm around them and saying, what's going on? You know, I mean, taking that 10 seconds and walking up and to talk to somebody and asking them, genuinely asking them, Bert, are you okay? You know, what's going on? Let's go grab a cup of coffee. Let's go get an ice cream and talk for a minute, you know. It doesn't take a whole lot from us, but it could be a game changer for them.
So Ryan and I were talking the other day, and part of going through this process, you know, this perspective, it's not a new perspective. It's who he's always been. But when you're an addict, you definitely are blinded by the needs of others. I mean, it is very self-absorbed addiction. And he was just why don't you tell them kind of the difference you see in yourself that you talked about of your perspective, your view. Obviously, you have mom and dad around that are incredible people, and watching them helps. But you went from not caring to caring.
Right. So I, right there in 2019, right towards the end when I lost everything, I honestly believe that part of the reason I lost everything and it was taken from me was I had lost all empathy for people. I was in my addiction, but I still thought I was better than everybody else. You know, I was working. I worked and had a good job. So I was making money. I could buy the things that I wanted to buy. I was horrible with money. But I had lost that human component that is so important, which is caring about others. And when I've gone through this process, I see people so differently now, you know, and the part of that was I was with my parents, and my parents, they are the most non-judgmental people you'll ever meet in your life. But being with them and going through this process, I'm able to see people in a whole different light now. You know, I don't see people, I don't get upset, oh man, that guy's arrogant. I just see him for his good qualities. You know, and I'm able to see so much, such a better world. You know, I don't look at the negatives, or I don't look at the things that the problems that they have. I just look at the good in them, and I'm able to see, you know, and it's a blessing to be able to see good in everybody, you know.
So I know we talked that we'd never really talk about certain things on this podcast, but I got to ask. Your relationship with God.
He is my best friend.
So are you making changes there too?
Oh yeah. I'm when you, it's so funny because I was raised in the church my whole life by great parents, and it wasn't until I went into AA that I really understood the church principle. You know, I mean, turning your life over to God, as you understand him, you know, and giving him the reins and say, look, you get me where I need to go.
Yeah.
You know, is a first step in recovery. And having faith that he is going to steer the bus, you just have to sit on it and ride and do the next right thing. And then the other thing, the other component that is huge in life is service. You know, if ever I am struggling or if ever I'm having a bad day, I find somebody that needs help and I help them, you know?
You know, I appreciate you saying that because I think over the last couple, 3 years, and whether that's COVID, whether that's politics, whether it's whatever beliefs, I think a lot of us, and I'm going to say this in my out loud voice, I think we've all went back into ourselves and become self-absorbed and almost like a protection, like a shield, and we've forgotten each other and service. I'm glad you address that. I'm glad you're doing that. I think we all could learn from that right now, and it's very noticeable, just being out and about. It's, we need to take care of one another. And the fact that you asked and said, hey, sometimes you just have to ask somebody, you okay? You good? Is there anything I can do for you? Instead of thinking, what am I going to do for me? I think that's important. I'm glad you touched on that.
You know, being his sibling, I mean, I love Ryan more than anything, and we've always had a really special relationship. And but I think the tough part is when you have a family member that has an addiction, you feel something is missing, you know, and fortunately figured it out at just the right time when we're like, doesn't matter what his past has been, he came in and he's really rescued the family at a time we really needed him and been such a blessing. But whether it's a spouse or a child or you yourself that has this addiction, the sun comes up. There is hope. And I think that when we are very self-absorbed and we're blinded to the things that save us, and that is really other people, and that is service. But I don't think there's ever a time where the person next to you doesn't need to feel loved. And if there's anything that we felt as a family is that Ryan hopefully always felt loved by us. Even in the moments we couldn't figure out what the heck he was doing or where he was, or mom calls me when I'm on a basketball trip saying, just don't worry if you see your brother on TV. He's armed and dangerous, and we all know him well enough to know that there could be something false there, or maybe not, but we love him. And, you know, Ryan and I were just talking the other day about no matter where you are, what you've done, how far you've gone, God's hand can always reach you.
And the good news is, brother, you got a lot of years of good still to do. I mean, you're still here. You're here for a reason. I mean, all those stories you told me, and screws and plates and wrecks, and man, you're lucky.
I am.
You're lucky. You're like a cat.
Oh, he has more than that. We've already decided that. He's like 15 cats.
I mean, you have a lot. You're here for a reason.
Yeah, I am.
And so I just want to thank you for being raw, real, sharing your story. I hope it resonated a lot. You give me a lot to think about. I'll be staring at the ceiling tonight. Thanks a lot, Dan. I'm gonna be tired for my tea time tomorrow.
Well, yes, it was awesome. Thank you, Ray.
Yes.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. And I know we went over time. I'm glad we did. This has probably been one of my favorites. I'm super proud of you. And man, I just want to say, if there's anything I can do, I'm happy to do it. I'm a stranger, but I'm proud that you've chosen to take your life back.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. So, Allie, my story now seems pretty weak compared to that one, but this has been a great podcast.
It has, and we all have a good story. It's our own, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Well, thanks, everybody, for joining in. I hope we were able to make a difference, and I'm glad you found something to believe in, brother.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
And we'll see you next month. So have a great month. Have a great time. Make sure you're aware. Take a minute to give service to somebody and to maybe make a difference and ask somebody how they're doing, because we could all use a pick-me-up right now.
For sure. We love you. Have a good weekend.
Take care, everybody.